You're listening to The Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 5th of October 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily in association with UBS.
Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily. We're live here on Monocle 24. This is Emma Nelson. And coming up on today's programme, as Spain's court suspends a session of the Catalan Parliament, stopping a declaration of independence, we'll ask whether the deep divisions in the country could revive Spanish nationalism. Also ahead,
we will oversee the biggest expansion in training for doctors and nurses. Shows what good the Chancellor's cough suite is.
As Europe's papers draw a direct comparison between the British Prime Minister's health and her ability to govern, we ask what now for the Conservative Party and for the country. Plus, we profile the man who just won the Nobel Prize for Literature, and we have a flip through today's Asian newspaper headlines. That's all ahead on The Monocle Daily, starting right now on Monocle 24. But first, a quick look at the day's other top stories. Iraqi forces say they have recaptured the centre of the town of Hawija, which is one of the last areas still held by Islamic State militants in the country. Hawija has been under the militant group's control since 2014. The United Nations believes that as many as 80,000 people are still trapped there. The girlfriend of the Las Vegas gunman who shot dead 58 people at a country concert said she had no idea what her partner was planning. Mary Lou Danley's comments came hours before police suggested Stephen Paddock had been living a secret life. They say he may have been planning to escape instead of shooting himself. Brazilian police have arrested the president of the country's Olympic Committee. Carlos Nuzman is facing an investigation as part of a cash-for-votes probe following Brazil's successful bid to host the Games last year. The arrest is part of the corruption investigation known as Operation Unfair Play. And the Russian Defence Ministry has drafted a law to ban social media posts by professional soldiers. The bill says photos, videos and other material uploaded to the internet could reveal military details that would be useful to an enemy. Automatic geolocation can show where a military unit is deployed. Those are your headlines. And a very warm welcome to Studio One. This is The Monocle Daily. I'm Emma Nelson and the time is just nudging 22:03 here in London. But we head first to Spain, a country on a watching brief. Earlier today, the country's constitutional court suspended a forthcoming session of the Catalonian Parliament, a session in which the region's president was going to declare independence. For those who voted in the referendum this weekend, almost all of them wanted a separate state. Spain has declared the vote illegal, but what of the rest of Spain? There are reports of a rise in nationalism. Well, to explain more, I'm joined now by Dr. Pablo Calderón Martínez from Aston University here in the United Kingdom. Welcome to the programme, Pablo. When we mean a rise in nationalism, what do we mean? Do we mean a rise in unity under one single Spanish flag, or a Spain without Catalonia, but nonetheless, although smaller, united?
That's a very good question, and I think it depends who you're asking, and it depends on the view you have. But I think there is certainly both sides of the equation are rising. I think there's a lot of people that are re-identifying and rediscovering traditional Spanish nationalism, and that's, in my view, not a very good sign. It's a nationalism that has been tainted in many ways by dictatorship. But we're also seeing the rise of a more, vindictive nationalism, perhaps, against Catalonia. That's, in my view, a little bit smaller and a little bit less relevant. But we're definitely seeing both trends manifesting themselves.
Well, let's explain this idea a little bit more. What in many ways is so wrong with patriotism? That there's often a confusion between being patriotic and being nationalist. And this is arguably a problem that the Spanish have had to wrestle with since Franco. Would that be right?
I think that's absolutely right. And I think, it depends who you're asking. I think there's a big difference between being proud of your country, where you're from, and that's absolutely fine, supporting them when they play football, that's absolutely fine. And there's a different story when you start making of nationalism and extreme nationalism something that almost uniquely identifies you. And in Spain, for many, many years, I wrestled with that question. I would say even before the Franco dictatorship, and this is a problem that has been coming for centuries, perhaps. And this idea that, you know, the idea of Spanish nationalism, unlike the French or the British, perhaps, certainly the English, was never quite consolidated. And there's always been an unease about what being Spanish means and what it is to be Spanish. And the Franco dictatorship did not help. So it's a long, long problem that has its roots in, you know, the foundation of Spain, really.
And what does this have to do, if anything, with the way that the Spanish authorities decided to handle this weekend's referendum? I think an awful lot of people were surprised by the speed and the force with which the Spanish authorities went into Catalonia. By 10 o'clock in the morning, they were bashing down the doors of school voting halls to simply stop the referendum from happening. And many people couldn't quite believe that that could happen now in a European state.
Yes, I mean, I agree the optics are not ideal. I was surprised by the reaction as well, because there was an easier choice, which was just like they did in the past, ignore it, say it wasn't a valid referendum, it wasn't a legally binding referendum, because it is not. And just let it happen and then just play politics with it. I was surprised by the reaction of the central government, for sure. But the reality is that this was not necessarily a legal referendum. This was not legally binding. I think the Catalan government acted irresponsibly as well. And it's not quite as straightforward as saying, well, just let them vote. There's a lot of problems. The sort of election, if we can call them that, the sort of vote that took place on Sunday wouldn't withstand the most minimal scrutiny in terms of, you know, electoral controls. There were no international observers. The ballot box was manipulated and moved around. There was no campaigning. There was no control on campaigning. There was no negotiation on the question. And as we know, referendums are tricky things, and there has to be a clear plan on what we're going to do after the referendum, and not just say, let's vote and let's see what happens. So I think the Spanish government didn't need to do what it did, and neither did the Catalan government.
Nonetheless, I mean, you mentioned all the things that made the referendum wrong, but it was, from the outside at least, an expression of a group of people of a desire to exercise their democratic right to freedom of speech, regardless of its legality. The ferocious way in which it was approached by the Spanish authorities, what does it say about a country's ability to compromise? Because there's been arguments saying that had Madrid said, this is not a legal referendum, but we appreciate your need to exercise a little bit more independence, so let's sit down and see where the give and take can come. Are there connections between an inability to compromise and this nationalism of which people speak now?
I think it's, I mean, to an extent, yes. The government in turn could have dealt with this better and negotiate better. But I think it's a bit unfair to categorize Spain in that sort of light. As I've said, it's a problem that's been carried on for centuries. And I think if anything has been good about Spanish democracy is that it's been a negotiated democracy. They've always managed to overcome these obstacles and negotiate solutions, not always the best or the long-lasting solutions, but at least there's an attempt to negotiate and deal with these issues in a democratic way, perhaps because of the memory of the Civil War, the memory of the dictatorship. So negotiation, consensus, and an understanding has always been the Spanish way of doing democracy, really.
So how do they do this, and how do they address this need for arguably a more pluralist culture?
I think we may be confusing issues here. What one is the reaction of the government in turn, the violent reaction, which I disagree completely, and there was no need for that at all. But at the same time, there was no need for the Catalan government to do the things the way they did these things. The political mood in Madrid is changing. The Socialist Party is tilting towards developing more of a federation. The Podemos Party and the parties on the left are very, very keen on having a referendum, a proper referendum negotiated with Madrid. And it was just a matter of really sitting down and negotiating this properly. And if the government in Madrid in turn would not negotiate and was completely against it, then take it to the political sphere, buy your time, wait until you have a friendlier government, and then negotiate this properly. You cannot act unilaterally one way or the other. And I think this is where there's a fundamental flaw. I agree that the optics are completely wrong, and they play massively against the Spanish government. And I cannot believe that I find myself defending the PP government in this way. But I do think we tend to forget that the Catalan government could have dealt with this a lot better as well.
Indeed. And I mean, there is a determination by people on both sides for everybody to have their own way. And we've just seen the Spanish authorities decide to cancel session of the Catalonian parliament on Monday. That will only serve to make things worse, won't it? And people will become more entrenched.
I think to an extent, yes. To an extent, again, the optics are all wrong. And I don't know how we really got to this place where we're, you know, at the verge of suspending the autonomy of Catalonia. And that's very, very sad. But in some way, I think the Catalan government and Puigdemont have been pretty smart, and they outmaneuvered the central government in the game of public opinion. But again, I do think the only possible solution going forward is for negotiation between the different parties. The only thing that the majority of people in Catalonia agree on is not independence, but is the fact that there has to be a referendum. And that is what most people in Spain are starting to converge upon. So that's the only thing that can really happen. We have to have a proper referendum, proper negotiated, with a question set out, campaigning, debate, controls, and then we deal with the question, with the answer to that referendum, whatever it may be.
Dr. Pablo Calderón Martínez from Aston University, thank you for joining us on Monocle 24. They say it's not the cough that carries you off, but the coffin that carries you off in. But could, for once, the rhyme be wrong? Welcome to Amateur Hour at yesterday's Conservative Party conference.
We will oversee the biggest expansion in training for doctors and nurses. And we... shows what good the Chancellor's cough suite is.
The sound of the British Prime Minister Theresa May supposedly delivering a speech at her party's annual conference to a triumphant applause, but instead she endured probably the worst bout of bad luck ever to be visited upon a public speaker. As well as the cough, there was a comedian who gate-crashed the podium and handed her a spoof copy of a redundancy slip, not to mention the bits of set which dropped off. But where does this leave the Conservative Party as the vultures begin to circle? Well, Paul Osborne is a regular Monocle 24 contributor and presenter, and he joins us now on the line. Paul, many of the papers today, most notably in Europe, have equated Theresa May's physical frailty with an inability to govern the country. How much of a point do they have?
Quite a good point. I mean, it was an extraordinary metaphor for the sort of the wheels falling off the Conservative Party. If you think about the huge reversal in British politics in the last 6 months. 6 months ago, we hadn't even had the general election called, let alone fought it. But we'd assumed that whenever it came, the Labour Party would be led to a catastrophic defeat by an unelectable leader, and the Conservatives would cruise to a crushing majority that would give Theresa May almost uncontrolled power. And here we are 6 months later. Jeremy Corbyn's just had a Labour Party conference that was like a massive party on the beach at Brighton. And Theresa May had had a pretty awful conference before she started to deliver that speech and coughed and spluttered and borrowed cough sweets off members of her cabinet and had some buffoon hand her a P45, which she then inexplicably took off him and then lay on the floor for journalists to take photographs of. And then, as you say, letters started falling off the backdrop because he couldn't cope with the sympathy applause that the crowd were giving her. She has lost her majority. She had just apologised to her own party for leading them off the edge of a cliff in this entirely unnecessary election, and then fate conspired to make physical the political crisis that she's been enduring for the last 3 or 4 months.
Well, this is exactly it, though, isn't it? That what we saw yesterday were situations actively out of her control. Admittedly, she is a woman who prides herself in the amount of control that she can wield, but yes, people have said that you can suppress a cough for an hour. There are doctors who can do anything for an hour to a human. But this really was the time, surely, that Theresa May should have actually got people's applause and support. Some parts of her party today have said, look, if she can get through that, she can get us out. Brexit looks like a walk in the park.
Well, did she get through that? That's the problem, is that you're right. You can't do anything about having a bad cold. You know, people like you and I spend a lot of time sitting in front of microphones, and from that perspective you could feel nothing but sympathy for the Prime Minister as she struggled through that speech. But that's actually the problem. The applause she got, the support she got yesterday, and a lot of the support she's got today has been pity. Prime Ministers don't need pity. They need respect, and to a certain extent they need fear, and she doesn't have any respect, and nobody at the top of her own party fears her or fears the power that she wields. And so you're right, you shouldn't lose your job because you've had a bad cold, but the issue is, how do you respond to that? And she didn't think about cutting the speech short, or maybe she could have gone off stage for 5 minutes and had a cup of tea or something. And equally, it's how you respond when, for example, Johnny Prankster shows up with a bit of paper and your initial reaction is just to carry on robot-like, reading out the speech that appears in front of you on the autocue and pretend it isn't happening. And it's that she's not fleet of foot, she's not quick on her feet, she can't react to situations. And prime ministers at any time have to deal with things a lot more serious than a bad cough and a bloke with a joke piece of paper, and this one in particular has to deal with Brexit.
Well, you mentioned the idea of the fact that she cannot think on her feet, but I was speaking to a former Conservative politician yesterday who told me that Theresa May is essentially an extremely good woman who cares deeply for the country, arguably more for the country than she does for her own physical well-being. Yet she comes a century too late. She is a deliberator. She's not a tweeter.
Yeah, she. I don't doubt her commitment, and I don't doubt that she takes very seriously the commitment that is involved in being Prime Minister. The problem is that she's just not very good at it, that she drifted into this job, remember, a year ago, and all of the other candidates managed somehow to shoot each other or stab each other in the back, and she was the last person left standing. And she wasn't tested. She wasn't tested in a leadership campaign. She wasn't tested by being put to the Conservative Party membership. She was anointed because there was nobody else left. And that's kind of the way that she's managing to cling on to the job now. The chief reason that she is still the leader of the Conservative Party is because, A, nobody else wants the job right now because it's such an awful, thankless task to be Prime Minister at the moment, and B, nobody in the Conservative Party can see anybody who is a remotely better prospect than someone that many of them admit isn't very good, which again is a reminder of just how far the supposed natural party of government has sunk in about 4 months.
So why, therefore, has there been so much focus, and I would arguably blame the media for getting the balance wrong here, on a supposed vulture-like campaign enacted by the Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson?
Now, Boris Johnson is a provider of good headlines, and it's still not absolutely certain what he is doing. Is he, by constant provocations, he's been in two newspapers now setting out red lines on Brexit that stray far beyond his brief as Foreign Secretary. He's made all sorts of other statements about other areas of policy that are nothing to do with what he's supposed to be doing. As Britain's chief diplomat, he was cracking jokes at a fringe meeting about bodies being swept off the streets of Libyan cities to make them better tourist attractions. Is he just trying to build up his career as a maverick? Is he showing a bit of ankle in the hope that the Conservative Party membership might suddenly think that he is their saviour? If he is, that ship seems to have sailed. The chairs of the local Tory parties are saying to their MPs they don't want to hear about people like Boris Johnson or the Chancellor, Philip Hammond, or people like that. They want to hear about the new generation of Tory MPs, people who were elected in 2010 or 2015, someone who can look like a blank sheet of paper. Problem is, Theresa May hasn't promoted enough of them into the cabinet for them to get a good look at them. I get the feeling that Boris Johnson doesn't particularly enjoy being a serious member of government holding an important office of state. He enjoys being a bit of a maverick, and having been very critical of Donald Trump last year and said he wouldn't go to New York because of the terrible risk of bumping into Donald Trump, he appears in some respects now to be channeling him a little bit, trying to just scatter chaos around in the hope that it will somehow build his brand.
So where does the Conservative Party head next? We could effectively meet the same criticism out to the Labour Party, a leader who, although enjoying substantially more popularity than Theresa May and the Conservatives, there is no one who could mount a challenge against Jeremy Corbyn, nor is there anyone to mount a challenge against Theresa May, simply because there isn't enough young, fresh blood. What does this say about British politics in general?
Well, there are talented new people coming up in both parties, the both main parties. The difficulty is that the people at the top are not giving them the opportunity to flex their muscles to show what they can do. If you go back 20-odd years, the then leader of the Labour Party, John Smith, gave very important roles to two of what were then viewed to be rising stars in the party, Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. He made one the shadow interior minister, one the shadow chancellor, and he allowed them, as it were, to sort of fight it out, go out into the public arena, get yourself on television, let the party membership see who they like the most. And we know who came out on top there. Theresa May hasn't done that. She hasn't promoted talented people who are newer to politics. She's kept with the old guard. The one person looking at the top of the government that you would have thought of as a possible successor would have been Amber Rudd, who is the Home Secretary, the Interior Minister. Now, she would probably be the number one choice. The only problem is that she very nearly lost her seat at the general election earlier this year. She only won it by a few hundred votes, which means that come the next general election, you can guarantee the Labour Party will be throwing everything they can at trying to unseat her. Well, you can't have a party leader and potential candidate for Prime Minister who is at imminent risk of being kicked out of the House of Commons. So even their possible best hope is someone they can't turn to.
One thing that has crossed my mind, which is in the wake of, let's say, Grenfell Tower, the disaster there, Theresa May was accused of being unfit to be Prime Minister because of her lack of warmth and reaction and speed to what happened. Immediately after the general election, she was described by the former Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne, as being a dead woman walking. On two occasions, she has just walked away, not unscathed, bloodied and bruised, but certainly not out of a job. I wonder whether this is like the political equivalent of a hydra. Chop one head off, another one will grow back, and those who criticise her will learn to rue the day they did.
Well, I await the ruing with interest, because you're right. You know, she got through the Grenfell Tower, which she handled incredibly badly. She got through the immediate aftermath of the election when, again, it all went horribly wrong. There were reports from inside Downing Street that she was so down and so incapable of clear thought that they even thought about getting people in from the SAS to give her a bit of a pep talk on finding a bit of inner steel. You're right, she's got through those two things, but I keep coming back to this idea that the reason that she clings on isn't anything to do with her own skills or talents. It's to do with the absolute dearth of talent around her, the fact that there is no better prospect. The Conservative Party, if nothing else, is ruthless beyond measure. And the moment they sense the possibility that somebody else offers them even a slightly increased chance of doing better in the polls or doing better in an election, they will waste no time in pushing her under a bus.
Paul Osborne, thank you very much for joining us on Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more. to find out how we could help you.
Contact us at ubs.com.
Buckle up, put the armrest down, and slide away that table. The third edition of The Escapist, Monocle's annual travel-focused journal, has landed. Our editors and bureau chiefs offer you their take on those far-flung places where opportunity and great design find a home. We head to Semmering in Austria, a sleeping architectural beauty being gently awoken by an ambitious set of hospitality entrepreneurs. Then we take a drive down Turkey's liberal west coast and dust up on Broome's long history of welcoming new arrivals to Western Australia. Also, our culture editor, Rob Bound, sifts the treasure from the trash in Benidorm. We also reveal the winner of Monocle's third annual restaurant awards, as well as a crop of comfy new hotels in which to rest your head. The Escapist is your summer set piece, packed with the sunniest and smartest insights from leaders in the travel industry. The Escapist, on newsstands now.
It's 22:25 here in London. You're listening to the Monocle Daily. We're live on Monocle 24. This is Emma Nelson. It is the prize some warn is a surefire way to creative barrenness. So let us sincerely hope that the gods of fiction fertility smile upon this year's recipient of the Nobel Prize for Literature, because he is indeed a well-deserving recipient. He's Kazuo Ishiguro. Well, John Mitchison joins me in the studio now. He's a co-founder and chief publishing officer at the crowdfunding publisher Unbound. And is an Ishiguro fan.
I am. It's a wonderful moment actually for fiction. Lots of writers in the offing. I think a lot of us thought that Margaret Atwood, who would also have been a wonderful choice, would get it. But I think Ishiguro is. I can't think anyone who loves fiction would not be pleased by this.
Why?
He's kind of an unclassifiable writer. I mean, he's written. I think he's been shortlisted for the Booker three times. He's won it once. He's unclassifiable because he writes a different book. You know, the thing that most publishers are terrified of, he writes a very different book each time. He doesn't write many. They play with genre. I think the most famous book, I guess, of his is The Remains of the Day, which is also one of the rare books that was made into a terrific film. And that was sort of a English country house novel with a butler, so a sort of genre that he kind of undermined. In the very last book he wrote, The Buried Giant, it's a kind of fantasy. It's got dragons and ogres, and the book before that, Never Let Me Go, was a science fiction novel, I guess an SF novel, although it was set in the 1990s. It was about cloning. When We Were Orphans, I guess you could see that as a detective novel. So he plays with genre. But through it all, it's a remarkable thing with a Ishiguro novel. You kind of know pretty quickly that it's him, the control, the beauty, the kind of quietness, but absolute mastery of language.
Indeed. And with the Swedish Academy, when awarding the Nobel Prize to Kazuo Ishiguro, actually described his work in an equally slightly confusing manner. I think we sort of got what you meant by that, but I fully appreciate now that we are dealing with a writer of extreme subtlety, but also of extremes, because they said it in novels of great emotional force, I get that, has uncovered the abyss beneath our illusory sense of connection with the world. What would you say to that incredibly obtuse way of form of praise?
I guess it's a really interesting thing with Ishiguro, because his books are at one level quite simple. They're fables. They have a sort of a metaphorical quality, which he's not a realist in the way that a lot of, but he writes in a very unflashy way. But the themes that are in them time and time again is the sort of of time, you know, this sort of sense that memories let us down, trying to recollect the past, emotional repression comes in, the inability for human beings to really communicate clearly with one another. There's always a strange sense in it that you're never quite sure. Maybe that's what that Swedish quote, you're never quite sure what's going on. You have a sense of kind of of foreboding often in Ishiguro novels when you're going through them. And they're not always books where you get a kind of, you know, what I would call a satisfying ending, but they live in the mind. You know, you can't cut, once you've read Remains of the Day, Stevens, and I mean, almost all his books, interestingly, apart from the very last one, are first-person narratives. So you're locked into this kind of a voice in the head. And Stevens, the voice of the butler, which Anthony Hopkins played so brilliantly in the film, is I mean, probably just the most famous. But they're all a bit like that. Unsettling.
I suppose had the Swedish Academy said you're not ever entirely sure what's going on, I think that might not have been quite as convincing a plaudit. One thing that I've always enjoyed about the way that Ishiguro approaches not only his work, but also his approach to talking to the press and talking about his work, is the fact that he's extremely honest about getting it wrong. And there's this tale about him having to effectively force himself to write even nonsense from 9 o'clock till 5 o'clock in the evening, all contact with the outside world, just in order to get the engine started. And then he writes The Remains of the Day in 4 weeks flat, which is astonishing. Obviously, maybe we should all try that. But again, when he was approached today by the I think it was a broadcaster who told him about the Nobel Prize, and he thought that it was fake news.
No, it's really, he is the most extraordinary and modest. I think that's one of the things that people will love about this. I mean, I happen to know that he has a kind of he doesn't go in for big advances. He's been published brilliantly by Faber and Faber for I think for all his novels, and I think I mean, he's the real thing, Ish. You know, it's a vocation. He takes a long time. There were 10 years between the last two novels, so I think that modesty belies also the fact that he's trying. I think one of the reasons he's got this prize is that his books will last for a lot longer because he doesn't set them in obvious contemporary kind of locations. I remember, I think, when he was trying to find a way of writing about the fracture of the modern world and Bosnia, he came up with what would seem like the most ridiculous solution to that problem, which was to write about England, a sort of mythical England between the departure of the Romans and the arrival of the Anglo-Saxons, where the sort of knackered Arthurian kind of knights wandering around and an elderly couple go on a search for their son. But you can sort of see that the themes that he's kind of pulling out of these stories are universal and help us understand. I mean, you think he's a really, for a writer who's obsessed with, you know, how we falsify the past, the kind of contemporary climate that we're living in with fake news, with what's happening in America, what's happening with the rise of fascism, which is something I know he's fascinated by. But he doesn't write about it directly, and that's what makes him a writer for the ages, I think.
He was born in Japan but moved to the United Kingdom when he was a young boy. Many people have said that it is that Anglo-Japanese influence which has created an incredibly sparse master of understatement in so much. Would you agree?
I think it's hard to avoid that. And he talks about the Japanese-ness. The first two novels that he wrote, Pale View of Hills and Artist of the Floating World, are Japanese books. But he says they were a kind of his attempt to imagine Japan, because obviously the memories that he had were of a very small child. But I think it's hard to resist those metaphors of precision, delicacy, almost kind of, you know, calligraphic kind of economy in terms of his storytelling. Although you do then have quite big novels like The Unconsoled, which is probably his most controversial book. James Wood, the literary critic, said it created its own category of badness. But then the brilliant Anita Bruckner thought it was a masterpiece. So he does divide critics.
And he's not Bob Dylan.
He's not, but he loves Bob Dylan. He is a songwriter. But I should imagine the Curse of the Nobel, let's see. I mean, I know he's writing another book at the moment. He talked about that this morning, but I'm sure everybody who learns of this news, as I say, who cares about fiction, will be thrilled for him.
John Mitchinson, thank you very much for joining us on Monocle 24. When a Estonia gained independence from the Soviet Union in 1991, its people hungered for the once elusive Western treats like foie gras from France. Now, however, inspired by the new Nordic food movement in Scandinavia, young Estonian chefs are going back to the forests to forage and create a new identity for a country focused on local seasonal ingredients. Well, Monocle's Justin Bergman met a few of the chefs behind this new food movement as a speaker at last month's Source Forum, an annual food conference showcasing the best in Estonian food.
When I arrived in Estonia in September for the Sauce Forum, my first dinner was prepared by one of the country's top chefs, Rano Pauksen, at a restaurant. The multi-course feast was a creative introduction to Estonian food, featuring locally sourced ingredients like pike perch served with fresh cabbage and algae, and fermented birch sap cake with spruce shoots and sorrel. The biggest surprise came, however, when I visited Pauksen in the kitchen after the meal. Every night, he and his partner Martin Mikus prepare meals in the tiny space not just for a restaurant, but also for a second restaurant run by the pair next door.
Hello. I don't know if you've heard, we have the other restaurant called Kakskovka right next door. So basically, we share the kitchen, we share the team, and some of our ideas as well. Kitchen isn't that big, but we can manage. But yeah, we've been dividing the kitchen in half, like this. So this side here is cooking for her, and this side over there is cooking for Kakskovka.
It's the kind of resourcefulness and ingenuity that has come to define a culinary scene which has fully emerged from the hardships of the Soviet era and is starting to come into its own and garner attention in the rest of Europe. This culinary renaissance is being driven by young chefs who came of age after Estonia gained independence and were inspired by the new Nordic food movement in Scandinavia to rediscover the local ingredients long since forgotten by their parents' generation. When Oit Tomik and Mart Metsalik founded their restaurant, Pojaka, in the Estonian countryside 7 years ago, there was little in the way of an Estonian culinary identity. Tomik explains that even in the high-end restaurants in Tallinn, the chefs preferred to use only foreign ingredients, rarely sourcing anything from Estonia itself. Most Estonian fish and produce was exported to other parts of Europe.
Even Estonian pike perch was sent from the fishermen straight to France. So I had one case when I had to order Estonian pike perch to Tallinn through France because I couldn't get it from the fishermen. Then the late night beers, we were thinking like, what the hell is going on? Like, we should use Estonian stuff, but why doesn't anybody do it? So that was the key idea, to make a restaurant that uses mainly only the local ingredients that we can get from the farmers, from the lakes, from the fishermen, stuff like that.
Even though the new Nordic food movement was popularizing the use of local seasonal ingredients in Denmark, Finland, and the rest of Scandinavia, it still took time for the concept to take off in Estonia, according to Metsalik.
The farmers were not very keen to bring stuff to your place, and they didn't know you. They kind of figured that it's easier for me to be on the marketplace and sell it there. But as we grew and everybody got to know what we were doing, they kind of trusted us, and we made a relationship.
In Tallinn, Jano Lepik and Christian Bersk had a similar idea for their restaurant in the medieval town center called Leib, which means black bread in Estonian. Hearty Estonian vegetables like beetroots, chanterelles, celeriac, and carrots feature prominently at Leib. In fact, there are two tartars on the menu, one made from beef, the other from carrot. According to Bersk, Leib's chefs also rely heavily on the forest, which makes sense given that about half of Estonia is covered by trees.
Foraging is very important. We actually have our own, basically we have a picking team that we collaborate with, but it's about mushrooms, berries. That is something that has been done in the area for a very long time, and it is, of course, obviously very important. For example, right now, which is very nice, very special for us, is that rowan berries are just becoming ready now. They're quite rare, so right now we're picking for rowan berries.
All of this was inspired by the new Nordic cuisine found in Estonia's neighbors. But Bersk says Estonian chefs have recently been keen to develop their own culinary identity.
Obviously, this has had enormous impact to everybody, and I would say it would be maybe even stupid to look away from it. We wouldn't have our own restaurant working with local ingredients if the Nordic movement would have been so strong. At the same time, For example, our food philosophy is more towards casual dining. We don't go so far eating moss or going those very interesting things fine dining can do those days. We're more maybe sometimes natural, but we still respect all the old curing methods, salting or fermentation, and
Another thing that sets Estonia apart is the fact that many top restaurants also make their own small batches of craft beer. Laib, for instance, produces three different beers, developing the flavors in such a way so they perfectly pair with the food on the menu.
We had no craft breweries in 2013. Today we have about 15, which is a lot for our very small nation. And we have tens and tens of gypsy brewers who just rent the brewery and go and make their own beer like we do.
Of course, with a culinary scene as young as Estonia's, it will take time before the country finds its own voice. Oit Serapuu, who works for the Estonia Tourism Board and spoke at the Sauce Forum about the future of food tourism, believes that Estonian chefs shouldn't just be looking to the north and west to find inspiration, but also to the east, to Russia.
One of the kind of fundamental question is also like, what is Estonian food for the locals? So how we define the Estonian food? And I think that this is a challenge because, like, historically we have considered our food as being potato, vegetables, and, you know, sausages, and not so much, you know, kind of this Nordic style of food. I think that one of the kind of way out for Estonia could be infusion of different approaches, the Nordic approach, but also the Slavic approach, using the kind of heritage from the Soviet time as well. Maybe not too afraid of them.
Mart Metselek at Pojaka Restaurant says that as Estonia grows in confidence, its chefs are bound to start revisiting the more painful years of the recent past and delving into the food cultures of its former occupiers.
We have managed somehow, maybe even thanks to the Soviet and the harsh times, that people had to be creative to put food on the table. So we have preserved that. And maybe thanks to that, we have this unique thing that if you take pickling stuff, it's really new all around the world. You know, we pickle stuff. We have pickled stuff, I don't know, hundreds of years. For us, it's a normal thing. As Estonia has been governed by many different governments, from Germans to Russians, we have all these influences. We are not this solitude like we have in Sweden, for instance. They have been in their bubble hundreds and hundreds of years, and they're like this safe haven. But we have been like influenced by many, many, many different cultures.
From the flavors I sampled in Tallinn, it appears the country is well on its way to creating a culinary style that is truly its own. Nordic cuisine, with an Estonian appreciation for simplicity, foraging, and developing flavors in the ways of their forebears. For Monaco in Estonia, I'm Justin Bergman.
Monocle's Justin Bergman reporting there. And for more food and drink stories, tune into The Menu tomorrow or to bed today, depending on where you are in the world, at 1900 London time. Ahead on The Daily, we have the newspaper headlines coming out of Asia. Stay with us.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
The time is 5:43 a.m. in Beijing, 22:43 here in London. It's time now to have a look at what's making the front pages in Asia. And I'm delighted to say John Everard, former British ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay, North Korea and Vienna. Have I got the list right tonight?
I wasn't actually ambassador in Vienna. But yes, I was there.
You've just been promoted. Also, regular Monocle contributor joins us in the studio to go through the papers and save me from my social embarrassments. John, tell us what you found.
Well, as everybody no doubt knows, the 2nd of October was the 148th anniversary of the birth of Mahatma Gandhi. And yes, I can see that Emma's been thinking of little else. And a lot of the Indian papers have been running all kinds of Gandhi stories, including, once again, the great mystery of his assassination. As everybody knows or thinks they know, he was killed by a Hindu nationalist called Godse, who burst into the room he was staying in and shot him three times. The trouble with this explanation of events is that the police reports of the time refer persistently to a fourth bullet. Moreover, the fourth bullet, it seems, could not have been fired either by the Beretta that Godse used to kill Gandhi, or by the other Beretta that was provided by his comrade-in-arms, Dr. Pachure, who was also condemned for the killing. It must have been fired by another weapon. Now, the case, of course, has gone cold. The police reports don't say what kind of gun might have been used, and they don't expand on the point. This is one of the great mysteries of Indian politics. Who fired the fourth round? What kind of weapon did they use? And why was it never pursued?
Why does this matter now?
It doesn't in the grand scheme of things. It's just a fascinating historical detail. If, for example, it turns out, though, that Gandhi was actually killed, because medically apparently it was the fourth bullet that was likely to have killed him, by somebody other than Godse, so perhaps not a Hindu nationalist, it does rather change the tinge of how he was killed and why.
Just looking, there's an enormous article in the Times of India which really does dig deep into this, into every sort of element of this thing. They have gone to town in trying to find the descendants of, you mentioned Dr. Pachure, who's considered the accomplice in Godse's crime. Then they're going to the sons, they're going to the father, they're going to the grandsons. But no one seems to want to talk about this nowadays. Why is that?
Well, yes, that is the big question. Is it just because they don't want to draw attention to their family? Or are they trying to cover something? Are there still people around who know more than they're saying? All kinds of other mysteries. The American vice consul was actually present at the killing, but never called as a witness. Why? There was a trail of evidence leading from the possession of the firearms used that was never pursued. Again, why? The police seemed at the time very eager to close the case quickly and not to pursue all kinds of normal lines of inquiry that you would expect any responsible police officer to dig quite deeply into. The whole thing ends in a great scatter of question marks. We'll probably never quite get to the bottom of this mystery, but it does look very much as if the standard story of how Gandhi died is perhaps only half the story.
Okay, let us move to Indonesia. Joko Widodo. Jokowi, a man who he's assumed power and he quite enjoys this power, doesn't he? So there's probably, I don't know how his reaction might have been of having to walk more than a mile because of a traffic jam.
Yes, 2 kilometres. He needed to attend the ceremony celebrating the 72nd anniversary of the foundation of the Indonesian Armed Forces, and which was actually in a smaller place just outside Jakarta, and he got caught up in one of Jakarta's traffic jams. Now, if he had been a Chinese leader, for example, the traffic would simply have been cleared and he'd been whisked away with a motorcycle escort. Joko Widodo, in my view, to his great credit, did nothing like that. He decided, after about 30 minutes of sitting stuck in traffic, that he was going to walk the remaining 2 kilometres to his destination. With his security detail doubtless in a state of high anxiety, trailing on behind him along with various other officials. One of those interesting things about this is that there's video of his doing this, and this happened just earlier today, and everybody in the streets is cheering. I mean, the man remains immensely popular after his election victory. No sense at all of any kind of personal threat to him.
What will this do for a president such as Jokowi? Because when people in great power decide to mingle with the masses, it generally does them no harm whatsoever. Did he need this boost?
He probably didn't need it, but I doubt if he's particularly displeased at having got it. Yes, it does him no harm whatever. The fact that he did this impromptu, with no added security, just his ordinary bodyguard he goes around with all the time, as presidents tend to, and that he was walking along, sort of waving at people and smiling quite happily, sort of interacting with the crowd. It'll do her no harm at all. It ought to be said that this must have taken just a little bit of personal courage. Indonesia is not a naturally violent place, but walking 2 kilometres along a congested road would have given anybody who had wanted to take him out plenty of time to organise. Nevertheless, he did it.
Let's move to the Philippines. The US-Philippines alliance is back on. It was looking rather shaky when Trump came to power, didn't it? Well, indeed, it was Duterte who was the one who flung the first mud.
That's right, yes. One of the great attributes of Donald J. Trump is he's been distracting attention from the almost equally mad Duterte. Duterte, when he first came to power, was really quite rude about the United States, talked about a separation from the United States, called President Obama the son of a whore, if I remember rightly, because President Obama had dared to criticise his rather controversial war on drugs, which involves an awful lot of extrajudicial killings. But a week ago, Duterte made a speech saying that he wanted to be more friendly to America. The speech was fascinating. It was deeply grudging. It was uttered through gritted teeth, where he talked about American help in freeing the Philippines from the Japanese and said, well, they weren't quite liberators, but they were quite handy in their own way, I suppose, or words to that effect. And then, crucially, at the end, he talks about Marawi. Of course, this insurgency been going on since May now, where the Philippine armed forces have been having great difficulty in bringing to heel a fairly small group of Islamists. And they have received an enormous amount of help from the United States. After all this talk about flirting with China, it is the United States, not China, who has come to the Philippines' aid in their hour of need. China probably doesn't even have the expertise to deal with something like Marawi, and Duterte has recognised this. So we have a rapprochement, and General Anyo, who is the head of the Philippine Armed Forces, has talked cheerfully about greatly increased military exercises and counter-terrorism activities. It's all back to normal.
And speaking of expertise, briefly, if you don't mind, John, what do you do when you're a snake expert and you encounter a 7 and a nearly 8-metre-long python?
Well, if you are Mr. Nababan, also from Indonesia, you wrestle it to the ground. You try to put a plastic bag over its head. Apparently, this is standard anti-snake technique, I've now learned. It was quite a combat. Mr. Nababan's arm is still quite badly damaged, but he managed in the end to kill the snake with repeated blows to the head.
He battered it over the head with a piece of wood.
There we are, making use of available instruments.
Goodness me.
In the best. And to the joy of the villagers, they were able to put the snake on display for a bit, and then they fried it and net it. That's an awful lot of meat for a fairly modest-sized village.
It's quite
7.8 metres.
Quite a long, a little bit like a very long hog roast.
Yes.
John Everard, thank you very much for joining us on Monocle 24. Let's turn now to this week's episode of The Entrepreneurs, our business programme. Mark Cho is co-founder of The Armoury, a groundbreaking temple to classic menswear in Hong Kong, and co-owner of Drake's, a highly respected English company known for its beautiful neckties. Both brands have flourished under Mark's watchful eye, so what lessons has he learned? Mark spoke with the show's producer and presenter, Daniel Giacopelli.
I went to school here in London, and when you were 16, you didn't have to wear a uniform. You were allowed to wear your own suit. So for me, I was like, oh, you know, I always saw my dad wear suits and they always look so great. I want to try wearing a suit too. So I started to look into it and I would like ask my dad and I would go and bug shop people and I would even like go to the library and find books. Because back then there wasn't really any information about it on the internet either.
No menswear blogs or anything like that.
Oh yeah, this was way before...
Pre-blog.
It was very pre-blog. I think this was before even WordPress was around. I just thought it was so interesting. Like, there were so many rules and there was so many layers of history and nuance that I just couldn't help but be really drawn to it. It was like a black hole for me that I'm still seem to be in. What was it, like 18 years later? So there you go.
And The Armoury, you know, it was founded in 2010 in Hong Kong. And of course, it's now an icon in the menswear world. But walk us back. I mean, I know it started with a chance meeting with Alan, your future business partner. And I read that it started over a shared interest in food. Or was that a joke?
That is a joke.
Because like, I read in your anniversary speech that you said you guys both bonded over tailoring and satay.
It's a joke. So Alan and I are both Malaysian.
Yeah.
And obviously one of the big Malaysian things you eat is satay. I was like, oh, it'd be funny if we bought the domain name MalaysianSatayEnthusiasts.com. And so we did, and we always like...
You really bought the domain?
Yeah, of course. Domains are like real estate. It's in my blood as a Chinese person to just be going around snapping that stuff up.
So where did you meet initially?
So we actually met at the tailor, we shared a tailor in Hong Kong called W.W. Chan, who I owe a huge debt of gratitude to. They're awesome. They do incredible work. And they actually really helped me break into the industry because I used to work in distressed real estate in China. I always had continue to have an interest in tailoring. And they would basically let me do like little odd jobs, do some salesy type stuff. And eventually they asked if I'd be interested in helping them organize a London trunk show. And I was like, yeah, sure, I would love to. So I started to put that together and I said, listen, would it be okay if I went with you on these trunk shows as a salesperson? And they were like, yeah, sure, it'd be great to have you. And that's where I really started to cut my teeth, like just dealing with their tailoring trunk show customers.
And you were doing this just for fun?
Yeah, I was just doing this for fun.
They weren't paying you or anything?
No, they weren't paying me. They gave me like a pretty good discount on suits and stuff. But frankly, anything they would pay me, I would just spend on suits anyway. So it didn't matter to me. You know, we developed a better and better relationship, and I really learned a lot from them. And I started to handle more stuff for them, including like trying to put together accessories for them and actually helping them find a new store. So Chen has been in Kowloon since, I think, the 50s or 60s. This was 2008 or 2009. They were like, okay, you know what? We've realized that all of our customers are on Hong Kong Island side, not on Kowloon side. So we should try and find a shop on Hong Kong side. And I had a few real estate connections in Hong Kong. So I was like, hey, you guys got anything cool, any interesting units? And eventually I found this unit in the Petter building, which at the time actually wasn't a great building.
Yeah. So it was a third floor location, right? And the building was kind of abandoned.
Oh, it was.
Or very abandoned.
There was like the low point for the Petter building was when they were well known for selling pirated goods. That was like the low point. And now Gagosian is in there. So it's like been a huge turnaround in the last 10 years for that building.
So you foresaw the potential or you just thought this could be a good deal?
I wish I could claim I foresaw potential. For me, it was a beautiful space. Like it was an old heritage building. A lot of the interior bits were intact. The ceilings are really high, like much higher than anything you could possibly find in Hong Kong. So it was a really unique space. And then it was literally above the subway station in Hong Kong, which is normally very expensive real estate. But because this was a protected heritage building and because it just wasn't really a building that was very wasn't really a building held in very high esteem, it wasn't that expensive to get in. So I was like, listen, you guys already have a established customer base. I know that the unit looks a little weird, but I think you should go for it. And, you know, there was actually one other problem with that unit. In feng shui terms, the unit is at the end of the hallway. And when you're at the end of the hallway, like dou dai, like it means that that's the end of your life. Like you don't want to go there because after you're there, you're done.
The ultimate no-no.
Yeah. But I was like, no, it's a great building. It's cool. Whatever.
So they didn't go for it though.
So they didn't take it, which is fine, like because they had other concerns. And frankly, like it would be taking a huge punt on basically some like young guy's kind of unsolicited opinion anyways, right? I always kept that spot in my mind. I was like, God, that's a beautiful spot. And one day, who knows? It so turned out that about a year later, there were some changes in my life. And Alan, who has been a very good friend of mine for a long time, there were some changes in Alan's life too that got us to say, well, maybe this is a good time for us to stop what we're already doing and change tracks and try something. And so that was kind of how the Armory was born. It was born off the back of having found this great space, having a good relationship with W.W. Chan, and just having this like very passionate interest for doing menswear in Hong Kong.
And thankfully, nobody bought that location.
And thankfully, no one took that location. But frankly, that location was available for the last, I think, like 10 years or something like that. Like we had to pull our own power into the unit because it had not been powered in such a long time.
So what was the first thing you did? Did you want to kind of go on and make your own clothing, or did you want to go on and curate these artisan brands that you eventually did welcome into the store?
We always wanted to curate artisans and brands. That was the initial thinking, and still is really the core of the Armory, right? The idea that we have a tagline for it. It's International Classic Artisanal Clothiers. So the idea is that we love this aesthetic of classic menswear, and actually internationally there are many, many people producing clothes within this aesthetic and doing a great job, but they tend to be fairly small, like family-owned companies or even just single people, and they don't get global exposure. So whatever they output tends to be just for their domestic market. We basically went around and started like collecting as many of these guys up as we could and then bringing them to Hong Kong.
Mark Cho from the Armory and Drake, sir, talking to Daniel Giacopelli on The Entrepreneurs. For a full version of that interview, just go to our website, monocle.com. That's all we have time for today's programme. My thanks to our producer Daniel Giacopelli, researchers Henry Reese Sheridan and Alessia Dell'Anna. Our studio manager was Sarah Miles. The Globalist is here in 8 hours' time with Georgina Godwin. The Monocle Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. For now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.